Marie Housley as our committee assistant this morning, LFO staff, Dallas Wynum. And we are going to try to get caught up today. I have two announcements for the committee. With the help of Cora and Dallas, we prepared a list of all of the questions that were raised yesterday, so we've captured them all in one place. I'm going to need to review the list with the co-chairs to get permission to go ahead. The co-chairs have been pretty rigorous about what volume of information they're going to ask from agencies and how the request will be filtered through the co-chairs. So we have the list, we've got the questions captured, and we're going to talk to the co-chairs about them. The other thing is that if we can work our way through the rest of the schedule expeditiously and perhaps get to a point on Thursday where we have a little bit of time left, we would ask Ms. Warner to come back, and that way we could have the opportunity to talk with her a little bit about the agency priority list, and rather than division, but look agency-wide. So hopefully that is an enticement to work our way expeditiously through today's offerings. And Darren, I apologize to you, the fact that you sat here yesterday and we didn't get to you. So would you come up and begin your presentation for the Budget and Management Division? Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Darren Hill, I'm the Administrator of the Budget Management Division. I'll start with the slide on page 5, and it's our program overview. Budget Management's main goal is to provide accurate statewide budget and management information, hence the name. We also prepare the Governor's recommended budget. As you know, we do that on a biennial basis. We ensure that the budget meets all legal requirements. As you'll see in a few minutes, basically ORS 291 specifies all the requirements of the actual budget document itself. We monitor activities and agency spending during the interim to ensure compliance with the legislative actions and the Governor's direction. Basically, if you think about the allotment process, that's the budget execution piece of this. And then we also monitor the position inventory system. So those are the two main things that we do as an ongoing kind of a monitoring activity. And then one of the other things we do is we assist in the coordination and budget in the budget for major capital construction projects. And as you probably remember in full committee, Greg Jeffrey came and spoke to you, and that's his group that kind of oversees that. To give you some historical perspective, budget management hasn't changed a whole lot in the last probably 20 years. The one thing is Greg Jeffrey's group, the capital investment group, did come in the 95-97 biennium. Other than that, the basic structure has remained the same. Turning to page 9, our mission is to give state leaders and the public objective and accurate information for the wise use of state resources. Our statutory authorities are there on that page, 291 again being the main section of the government. Our goals, the ORBIT system is the Oregon Budget Information Tracking System. It's the statewide budget system. It is actually fairly new. It was implemented 2 biennia ago. We had had a statewide budget system that had not been updated in over 20 years. And we have an ongoing package, as you'll see later on in our budget, that continues the implementation of that system. I guess I take fairly good pride in that. I was not in charge of the division at the time, but it was, you didn't hear much about the rollout of it, and I think that's probably a good thing. You tend to hear the bad, you don't tend to hear about the good. I think it's probably a good thing. It was a very successful project for us. It came in on time and on budget. Another one of our goals is to increase access to the central system. And then continue increasing training and education for agencies on budget issues, processes, development, and management.
Darren, is ORBIT's big enough, have enough capacity, computing capacity, to accept additional budgets? Let's say that the Oregon University system was folded into ORBIT's. Do you have enough capacity now?
Madam Chair, absolutely.
Thank you.
As an aside to that, they actually do have their budget in the ORBIT system. It's probably not to the level of detail that some of the other agencies are, but they do utilize the system, and we do have budget information in there for them.
Thank you.
Turning to the org charts, you're not going to see a whole lot of difference between the current biennium in 0305 and 0507, so let's concentrate on 0507. The administrator's position basically oversees the division. I will start with Orbitz. Again, that is the ongoing continuation of implementation of the Orbitz project. Those positions are renewal duration, so every single biennium we have them renewed in a policy package. The statewide budget and reporting section, they're the folks that oversee the execution systems that I spoke about, the allotment and the position system. They also do all of the auditing of the numbers in the statewide system, which now, as you probably know, the Legislative Fiscal Office and Budget Management are using that system quite a bit. And so obviously it's only as good as the numbers that are in there. So those are the folks that oversee the numbers for us. The capital investment section, I'll get into a little more detail of what they do, but that's Greg Jeffrey and his staff. The policy and budget section, those are our budget analysts. And then our administrative section is the folks who take care of us, if you will.
Question? Thank you. In the Orbitz section now, with eight positions there, how sensitive is that category to turnover? Are there one or two technical people in there that if they were to move on, that section of the organization would shut down until we found a replacement?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, absolutely not. This project has been looked at, and you have to remember this is a fairly large project for us. We are now in more of a modification, adding on some more of the features that we needed. And we started with a fairly small scope for implementation purposes to get it up and get it going. We have since added, the Legislative Fiscal Office, you're going to see their staff this time are actually inputting numbers into the system and using it as a centralized system. But we have taken, the project manager for that project has taken great care to make sure that we have things double and triple covered and those kinds of things. So it should be just fine.
Thank you. Please continue.
Sure. Getting into the programs and services, again, I covered a little bit of these just in the org chart, so I'll go through them very quickly. The budget and policy section.
Madam Chair. Representative Crowe.
Thank you. Darren, forgive me for interrupting. I wanted to know in the 0507, in this org chart, how many of those positions are vacant? Are they all filled at this time? Do you have some do you anticipate vacancies?
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, at this time we only have two positions that are vacant. One of them is the Deputy Administrator, which that job announcement closed yesterday. I plan on filling that position post-haste. The other position is in the administrative section, and that has to do with Lori in the director's office working with our staff so that we're kind of combining the administrative staffs between the director's office and budget management to try to make it a little more efficient. So there is a vacant position right there right now. At this time, I don't foresee us filling it. But we're still in that review stage.
Thank you.
And just for the committee's benefit, vacancies are a pivotal part of phase two when we can probe down deeper into where all the vacancies exist, and we've captured that on our list.
Okay.
Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Again, I'll go through these quickly. The budget and policy section, those are our budget analysts for the most part. The capital investment section, that's the group that oversees debt financing for the state. That was Greg Jeffrey, and I think he kind of came in and gave you a fairly good overview at the full committee of the things that he does. Our SABRES folks, the statewide audit and budget reporting section group, again, they're the folks who oversee the audit and make sure that the systems are operating, the dollars are correct in the systems, and the information that we get out of them is correct. The Orbitz group is, we have a policy package again this biennium for these folks. They're the ones that design and implement the next phase of the Orbitz requirements. Ken Rocco, who is the legislative fiscal officer, and I basically help set the priorities of that. And we go out and talk to agencies, and we talk to all the users of the system to try to figure out kind of how the priorities are going to be set for the next biennium of what's going to be looked at and what's going to be worked on. just a few highlights here. I think what I'd like to point out is in the latest release of Orbitz, we're really concentrating now on getting some more statewide information. We're trying to combine the accounting system and the budget system to get information on expenditures at the budget level. That had been kind of an automation nightmare in the past. And so folks have been working on that for the last 2 years. Legislative Fiscal Office was a big driver in this one. And you will, I'm sure, see some of that information as we start going further into the budget process. The other piece of this is we've implemented major narrative into the system, which, I will be perfectly frank, we took a giant step forward. But we still have a ways to go. The goal here is to eventually be able to push a button and create documents. And so you will have that consistency in those kinds of things that I'm sure you folks can appreciate. Our programs and services ensure legal compliance and provide direction to agencies on legislative and gubernatorial policies. We are in charge of what we call the budget instructions, which basically lay out the governor's policies for building the governor's recommended budget. We assist policymakers with policy and financial analysis, usually in coordination with the Legislative Fiscal Office. We oversee the issuance and tracking of the certificates of participation. Again, that's Greg Jeffries, folks. Manage the statewide systems and provide the general public and state agencies with information on state resource allocations. We are trying to put more and more information out on the web, but we still get a number of phone calls from the general public as well asking us for information, and we provide that for them. I'll turn to performance measures now. I'm on page 23. Performance measures has been kind of a sticky wicket for the Budget Management Division. I think I've talked with Ken Rocco at the Legislative Fiscal Office, and we're in kind of a difficult place in trying to measure things. For this performance measure here that's talking about the Budget Process Quality Index, while it gives you some information, and again, this is a kind of a timing issue, the 2003 data should be out soon. It comes out after the 2004 book, which I believe is going to be out in March. But if you go back and look at that, the components that comprise the index are things like a rainy day fund and those kinds of issues. They're outside of the control of budget management. I'm not sure that they're a great performance measurement tool for budget management. That being given the case, I mean, there's other things in there that we probably get a good quality index mark for, such as a good central debt service function. And again, I don't know that those are necessarily, those are more policy-driven kinds of things than they are actual performances of budget management. We have looked at what other issues are. Our other performance measure deals with the customer survey. And to some degree, that's probably a pretty good idea if you look at the next one. But again, when you are the keeper of the gate and you're monitoring and reviewing folks' budgets, there are times when you have to tell people no. And we try to do that. We try to work with them to, you know, make sure that folks are in legal compliance and are doing what the intention of the legislature and the governor are. But sometimes you have to say no. So we've really struggled. I will be the first to admit. We've looked at things like meeting statutory deadlines and those things. But frankly, if it's a statutory deadline, we have to meet it. And I don't see a whole lot of use of us putting 100% compliance in for some of the measurements.
Senator Morsell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What about the Orbitz system as a priority or as a measurable outcome? You said that you're improving the narrative. I mean, it seems to me that those are kinds of things that we would be interested in.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, I would be happy to work on performance measures. I really would. I'm looking at what would tell folks the right story about whether we're doing the job or
May
not.
May I?
Follow up.
I think we're interested in efficiency in the process as much as anything else. And so if you're working toward achieving a goal, I think that would be a performance measure. And it's a measurable outcome, and I'm interested in reading the narrative that you're going to include.
Madam Chair, Senator Morsett, thanks. And we'll, when we come back in later phases, we'll talk more about what those efficiencies
Thank
are.
Thank you.
Continue, please.
Sure. Quickly turning to the prioritized list, these are ranked in order. The policy and budget function would be ranked number one, and capital investments would be ranked number two. Not that I don't think the capital investments is as important as the policy and budget, but I think that the main core mission is policy and budget. The capital investment group is actually the last place where we actually got a position, and that was in the last biennium, because they have had to take on more and more things as we have gotten into lottery bonds and appropriation bonds and those kinds of things. So we can have a little discussion here as I move on to page 29 in our reduction list. These reductions, the first two positions are our budget trainee program. And if you, what you folks will see is we have two folks that come in on basically a two-year basis. As you can see, they're at two positions at $185,000 over a biennium. They're not paid very well. These folks are very well educated. They're looking to get into the state process. This has been a program that has been around for a very long time. They tend to carry some of the smaller agencies. You will see the folks that are currently in budget management. We have two of them. They will come in and they do mostly boards and commissions, and then they also take on the legislative branch and the judicial branch for the most part. If we had to eliminate these positions, besides giving some folks a step into the state process to see this, we would also have to carry assign those work assignments out to other analysts.
Senator Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. I'm struggling with the prioritized list on page 26 and the level of lack of detail that's provided in that. Is there going to be an opportunity to break out what you include in policy and budget at, what is it, 13, some several millions of dollars? Or is this what we're going to see?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, that was the level of detail that I was going to go to. If you would like to see more, we can break it out. Basically, our core function, if you look at what the Orbitz group does, they're a policy package, and they will sit on their own anyway as we have discussions about budget. Basically, what you're seeing there is the auditing function along with the analysis function. The two do not stand alone in preparing of the budget and taking care of the system and getting out good information. We're talking about a division of 35 folks, but if you would like to see more information or have it broken down to a lower level of detail, we'd be glad to talk to you about that.
It's your prerogative. It troubles me.
I think we're still continuing to struggle with how these 10% prioritization lists are appearing, and it's probably going to be an ongoing conversation with the co-chairs apropos the exchange that occurred at the committee yesterday. And just how useful the 10% reduction lists are as they are presented here. So I think this is a conversation in progress.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And along those lines, Darren, and I appreciate that you have focused on what your core mission is, and that's policy and budget. So then I find it ironic, though, that in one of your 10% reduction options is to eliminate two of your budget analyst positions. It's a sizable chunk of money. I mean, it's almost $400,000. But you make the statement that it does erode the core services of your divisions. So I guess I'm struck by why you would do that instead of not try to reduce out of capital investments. What's the reasoning there?
Madam Chair, Representative Krepa, if you look at our second group, at our second set of the eliminations, basically on page 30, we do eliminate one of the capital budget analysts. What I tried to do in looking at this was to say, if I had to take a reduction, where could I take it without having as little impact as possible on the outside world, if you will? And these folks have some of the smaller agencies. They have other funded agencies, and right now our folks still work overtime to get out the governor's budget. We would have to assign these out to other folks. I think the jobs could still be done. Just we're going to put a lot more workload onto other folks. I saw this as having less impact as going to the capital investments group, which only has three folks anyway. And if you eliminate one third of the workforce there, You're taking away in an area where the legislature has said we're going to add another position to deal with workload. So I tried to go to the area where I looked and said, well, I think this will have the least impact. I wouldn't want to take it, but if that was the case, I think that would be where the least impact would be.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to discuss the capital investments group perhaps later.
Sure.
I would love to explore that.
Sure.
And the significance of it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We'll catch that.
Representative Smith. Thank you, Madam Chair. I know how important it is to keep this process moving, and I'll hold all further questions to the end. But I do have a statement. I think it's important for everyone in Ways and Means to understand that the prioritized list and HB 3182 are two separate and distinct activities. They're two separate tools, and to try and tie the two together is not in line with what the co-chairs wanted us to do. One is a statutory obligation. The other is an exercise in prioritizing an overall budget. And I think it's important for us to keep those two activities separated. And as agencies and departments come forward to ensure we're not allowing those two to get meshed together, because they really are two separate. And with that, I will hold all questions and all comments to the end, Madam Chair.
I wrote that down. Dallas. Ms. Parker.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Smith. Actually, Dallas and I had a conversation about exactly this topic yesterday. I just wanted to point something out to you, which probably will not clarify the topic, so I will just preface the discussion with that. The request from the co-chair was for, as you pointed out, a prioritized list and also for an additional 10% list. So for DAS, because we didn't take most of their House Bill 3182 reductions during the governor's budget process, for many of the reasons that you have all pointed out here today, that the centralized nature of what DAS does is intended to actually save costs in other agencies. So we didn't take a lot of those options because they didn't make sense, as you've already pointed out. So a lot of the options that they're presenting to you today for their secondary 10% list, which was requested by co-chairs, are the same as the reductions that were submitted by them for the House Bill 3182 statutory requirement. And there's been a little bit of a confusion because DAS in their presentation identified those cuts as House Bill 3182, again, because they happen to be the same list of items because they weren't taken in the first place. In fact, they are responding to the co-chair's request for an additional 10%. Now, I only point that out because when you get into other committees, especially where you're dealing with general fund and lottery fund agencies, it's very likely, actually very probable, that agencies will have already taken their first list of 3182 cuts. Those will already have been taken off the board and incorporated into their budget. So the list you'll be seeing of 10% cuts there will in fact be a second set of 10% cuts, making them obviously much deeper cuts into the budget than that first list. So I just wanted to clarify that for you because you know, with the headline being House Bill 3182 here, it's a little bit of a misnomer for you. So.
And I think if we can move ahead and get through this, having Lori come back on Thursday and discuss agency cuts might be a clarifying exercise.
Anything else from you, Madam Chair?
You're about at the end.
Okay, I am done.
Great. Any final questions? Good. Thank you very much. Dr. Goldberg.
Morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bruce Goldberg. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Office for Health Policy and Research. It's actually a pleasure to be here this morning to talk with you about our office. I'm proud of what we do and glad to share it with you. As I think you know, Oregon spends over 20% of its budget on health care. Oregon, the state is actually the largest single purchaser of health care in the state of Oregon. And what our office does is provide analysis and policy support to the legislature and the governor around health policy issues. We carry out our mission through a number of means, primarily through data collection and analysis. We staff a number of statutorily required committees and commissions. We are funded through a combination of general fund dollars, which is actually the smallest piece of our budget, and some federal grant fund, federal match, and grant funding. Our mission is to help the state achieve the goal of everyone having an adequate level of quality health care at what is an affordable cost to both the state as well as to individuals. To turn to our org chart, which I'll go through briefly and then spend a little time on the programs and services, which I think will give you some detail as to what those boxes are. We staff the Health Policy Commission, which was created by a bill last year by Representative Cruz. That actually serves as an overall policy advisory group to the state. We staff the Health Resources Commission, which looks at medical technology reviews and is responsible for the evidence-based drug list, which saves dollars to the Oregon 13. Health Plan about... I'm moving quickly, so no. Sorry. On page 13.
Yeah, okay.
The org chart. The Health Resources Commission, their primary responsibility right now is the evidence-based drug list, which serves as a cost-saving mechanism for the Oregon Health Plan. The Health Services Commission, which manages the prioritized list of healthcare services, ranks the services, and is also responsible for benchmarking payment rates for the Oregon Health Plan. We have a policy and analysis unit that actually provides policy analysis, data collection that we're statutorily required to collect. And we have a... Last year, the legislature unanimously passed Senate Bill 875, which established the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, which is a bulk purchasing program to provide low-income citizens and governmental agencies with prescription drugs at the lowest possible price. That was put within DAS, and our office has been responsible for carrying out that program. Moving on to the next page, which is page 15, Programs and Services. I think I went through a number of these just to give you a sense of what we do in terms of data collection and analysis. And we monitor healthcare uninsurance in the state. I think many of you saw recently the report showing that individuals without healthcare insurance in the state is increasing. We statutorily collect data around hospital performance and hospital costs and just released a report on hospitals in the state. We collect data and information about long-term care, the numbers of beds in the state, the ability of the state to meet its goals in terms of long-term care. We do physician and health professional workforce studies. We've been analyzing all of the changes in the Oregon Health Plan, providing reports to legislators on what's happened with premium payments, copays, reductions in services that have gone on, and efficiencies for the Oregon Health Plan. Charity care by hospitals. We look at the medically needy. Really looking at providing policymakers with the information they need to make decisions.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since you're involved in health policy research, it's a timely issue. I've been getting inquiries from constituents about a consumers union drive right now to regarding hospital infections and the reporting of that. In fact, I've had some policy research being done by interns in my office right now. And recently, some states have been passing legislation to track infection rates in hospitals. Is that anything that your office tracks? Do you monitor that? Do you do any research on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, our office does not directly do that. The state established the Patient Safety Commission last legislative session, which is setting up a voluntary reporting system to look at many of those issues. That commission is not within our office. We indirectly deal with those issues member of our staff is involved with the commission, and we certainly follow and are involved with that, certainly an important health policy issue, but it's not directly connected to our office.
I see. Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
I think I went, as we go through the programs and services, I think I went through the Health Resources Commission and explained to you its function in technology assessment, the health services.
Senator Morse.
Thank you. Dr. Goldberg, with respect to the assignments for the Health Resources Commission, it looks like that a lot of that is already done in the private sector in terms of that information, particularly with evidence-based prescription drug lists. And is this a really a necessary function to be performed?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, the evidence-based drug list actually is much of our work is used by the private sector. So I wouldn't say that it's repetitious. Certainly, there is a lot of medical technology that is assessment which is done within the private sector. And currently, we're looking with the Health Resources Commission and devoted the last meeting to trying to define what is the role of the Health Resources Commission in further health technology assessment. My personal opinion is that there is a lot of assessment that goes on, but it happens in a variety of silos without actually any sense of unity within the state, and that a particular piece of technology is assessed by several different organizations. There are a variety of recommendations that are made, the results of which are 90 to 95% similar, that it creates a tremendous amount of confusion within the provider community, which often uses that technology under the guidelines that have been developed by these variety of different organizations, and that there's probably a great role in the state and to be able to coalesce and to bring some consensus around some of the recommendations that currently exist. I think one of the issues that we've learned is that all this healthcare is related, and that we have to start to take an approach to healthcare in the state that doesn't segment PEB and Medicaid and Medicare and the private sector, because indeed what happens in all these sectors are all related, and the assessments that we need to do need to be coalesced.
Thank you. Dr. Goldberg, continue, please.
Prioritized list is managed through the Health Services Commission. We staff the Medicaid Advisory Committee, which is a federal and state-required advisory committee to the Medicaid program. I think I mentioned the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, Senate Bill 875. We also staff the Advisory Committee on Physician Credentialing, which really does in many ways for physician credentialing what I was explaining about in terms of technology assessment. We've gotten together a group of individuals around the state from the variety of credentialing organizations, hospitals, health plans, et cetera. And what we've done is all agreed on a uniform credentialing application for the state so that a physician doesn't have to fill out six different applications for every health plan that they provide services under and three for every hospital that they have admitting privileges for.
So would those be available, Dr. Goldberg, to I sat on a little hospital board, and as a layperson trying to soldier through physician credentialing, frankly, they might as well have been doing the whole thing in a foreign language. Is the work product that you have now available to local lay boards that advise community hospitals that may have been involved in physician credentialing?
Madam Chair, up on the web, available, and we hope actually being used by those hospitals around the state. And that was exactly the intent.
Good. Given the almost endless liability that accompanies that, that's a very good thing. Senator Morsett.
Thank you. I want to go back to the evidence-based prescription drug list. Now, talk about OHSU's involvement in ferreting out the good drugs from the bad drugs and how they are ahead of the curve.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, what we've done with the evidence-based drug process has been to
go drug class by drug class and do an evidence-based assessment. What we as a state do is contract out for that work to experts on evidence-based medicine. We contract that out to Oregon Health Sciences University, which has one of 12 federally funded evidence-based practice centers in the country. These are experts who take a very systematic look at the evidence from a scientific standpoint. This is what they're trained in. They're trained in how they gather the info, how they synthesize it, and the product they produce. We take the information from Oregon Health Sciences University, which is the evidence, and then have the Health Resources Commission consider that evidence and basically come up with recommendations upon that evidence. The Health Resources Commission is made up of physicians and lay individuals. So actually what we have is the best science and evidence along with local decision making.
Did they not find some faults with drugs that remained on the market and were finally recalled later to show? Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, you know, indeed, as they've looked through drug class by drug class, they've found information both in terms of effectiveness and both in terms of problems with every medicine that they've looked at. Certainly, they've looked at and discussed some of the problems with some drugs prior to their being removed from the market. I think most notably is Vioxx. Actually, this was discussed, I think, in the newspaper. People saw that Vioxx was removed from the market because of its effects on individuals' hearts. Vioxx is a med used to treat arthritis, but it also can cause damage to the heart. The Health Resources Commission actually looked and considered some of that information prior to it being removed from the market, actually about 2.5 years ago.
Thank you.
In terms of performance measures, that's a blank page on your form, but let me spend a moment talking to you about the performance measures that we contribute to. We certainly contribute to approximately 10 performance measures that are put forth by the Progress Board around healthcare in the state. Early prenatal care, we certainly contribute to that through the policies that the state has to encourage access to early prenatal care, and indeed we've seen some improvements of that in the last decade. Infant mortality, another Progress Board measure we've seen reductions in, and is really directly related to our ability to get women into prenatal care early. Immunizations for 2-year-olds, another Progress Board measure we certainly contribute to through policies to expand access to health care for children. HIV diagnosis, another Progress Board measure, fell in the state from 576 in 1991 to 292 in 2002. Percentage of adults who don't smoke in the state has gone up. That's a good thing. We've certainly, through policies and programs that the state's been involved in, contributes to that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Avakian.
Thank you. It sounds like you're describing service delivery things that you do in addition to gathering and disseminating research. Is that right? And if that's true, it would be helpful to me if you talk just very briefly in each of those categories about what service delivery provides.
Madam Chair, Representative Avakian, actually, we don't provide direct service delivery other than the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, which was new to our office.
Then maybe describe what you mean by contribution when you talk about your contributions.
Sure. In terms of, take for instance, early prenatal care. Many of the policies that the state has moved to in terms of who qualifies for the Medicaid program and what services they get. One of our priorities has clearly been to cover pregnant women. And we've designed a Medicaid program that actually gets pregnant women into care. Through the Medicaid program, the ways that we've structured the local delivery systems to actually get services to women who live in communities throughout the state actually helps be certain that women get prenatal care early. So it's not just the fact that we provide a Medicaid benefit to individuals. That doesn't solely get them prenatal care. We need to provide policies in the infrastructure within the Oregon Health Plan to be able to be certain that pregnant women throughout the state have access to that. Our office clearly contributes to that through our work with OMAP and through DHS in setting the policies around the Oregon Health Plan, in monitoring and ensuring that women do get access to prenatal care. So for each of these, although they are clinically related, certainly the way we organize and deliver health care in the state contributes to that. We've made clear choices based on where we put our resources that do and don't contribute to many of the successes or failures that we've had in this. The fact that the Oregon Health Plan covers smoking cessation actually does contribute to the fact that there are more adult non-smokers in the state. That's a clear prioritization of where the state puts its resources. The Health Services Commission contributes to that, et cetera.
Thank you.
In terms of prioritized lists, another page which is blank for you. We've prioritized our services in three ways. Number one is our data collection and policy analysis as being our primary service. That's the mission and core of the organization. The second priority for our office is staffing the commissions and committees. And the third is the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, which I believe is, you know, Representative Avakian in essence pointed out is a little bit of a different piece for our office, because that's service and service delivery as opposed to policy analysis.
Senator Morse.
Bruce, you don't have performance measures? Let me just say something and then you can respond. 875, the implementation of what seems like would be a performance measure. I hope that you're not afraid to put things down that won't work. I mean, you have a goal, and you've got to give it your best shot. So I would, you know, there's all kinds of things that I think should be listed that you are working on. Now, if you don't succeed, in 2 years you will come back and tell us why you won't succeed. But I think the purpose of performance measures is to let us know what you're doing.
Right. Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, our office is in the process of developing performance measures that more directly meet the day-to-day things that we do. The ability of our office to provide timely information to legislators, the ability to get a program up and running,
yeah,
the numbers of drug classes that the Health Resources Commission looks at.
Ms. Parker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Morissette, I also wanted to clarify, because this discussion came up yesterday, I think, with the operations division, I think it was. The performance measures that are being identified by agencies here within this document are those measures that have been identified, I believe, by the Progress Board as key performance measures. They have a very specific linkage to some of the information that the Progress Board has put together. Each of the divisions has a number of operational and performance measures that they also look to for every day, and that was one of the items that I think is on the list we prepared for the chair yesterday. As far as how we're going to solicit or whether the co-chairs are going to approve solicitation of that information, et cetera. So just to clarify, because you'll be seeing that in a number of the other divisions that come before you as well.
I think that is essential information to have, because that's why performance measures were created, is for us to see what you're attempting to do and to track it. So we need that information. Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
10% reductions. We have prioritized our 10% reductions as coming out of the charge to the Health Services Commission to provide actuarial work to set a benchmark rate for the Oregon Health Plan. and we believe that we can take a series of reductions in that work, which will have the outcomes as listed here, and those have been integrated into the agency's full reduction list.
Is that it?
That's it.
Doctor, a question that occurs to me when I listen to you talk about your data collections, monitoring, policy evaluation, and your ability to wade through complex medical policy and help us. One of the issues that I think we're going to talk about this session, and I know we had dueling experts last session, is the question of the combination of a single healthcare provider for K-12. And we had dueling actuarials at the end of last session. We had dueling certified smart guys coming in. And no real neutral third party to provide policy input to the legislature to help make the decision. Is that an area where your office is going to be able to help us assess whether or not the creation of a single medical pool for K-12 makes sense for the state?
Madam Chair, if asked to do so, absolutely. I actually see the role of our office as doing exactly that. It is providing the kind of unbiased, informative information to allow policymakers to make decisions. And I think we've, worked with closely with a variety of legislators with ideas from all across the political spectrum, providing them with information to do exactly that.
Well, it may be above my pay grade to ask to have that information tabulated by your office, but you might want to let your staff know that folks would be interested in having that neutral source of information against which to weigh a major shift in state policy.
Madam Chair, if asked to do so, we will be happy to.
Any other questions for Dr. Goldberg?
I would, if I may, and I would add that I think that's a great request, both in terms of a cost-benefit type analysis, I think would be good, because one of the big debates is what the cost savings is on that type of a pooling of insurance, but also how that might, various forms of that might affect the benefits that folks get. So, I'd like to know whether it increases or decreases access to health care in a pooling system like that.
Let me nuance that a little bit more. And where such a plan might live, I'm looking at your colleague, Ms. Thorne, in the audience, and understanding that at one or various points in time, people have suggested that PEB take over that statewide pool, and arguments advanced why this is not a good thing, that the demographics of a K-12 pool differ from the demographics of the state employees. I'd certainly welcome having a neutral third party take a look at that data and be able to help us understand whether PEB would be a reasonable home for such a plan.
Madam Chair, I think that there's really two issues that you have to wade through in terms of that. One is, as you said, the dueling numbers. But I think the larger issue is the policy implications for the state, and really the vision that we have as a state for what we want to do and how we want to deliver health care, and what are the efficiencies and savings we can get through some of the things that Senator Morse was talking about in terms of being able not just to save in the short term, but in the long term, how we can agree on standards of care, how we can look to provide the best health care is the best health care, how we can look to do that. And those are really the two issues. One is the costs, which in some ways are both short-term, but the bigger issue is a longer-term policy discussion of whether we want to create silos of healthcare delivery or to look at how we can bring some of that together.
Senator Morsette.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Don't forget the contractual agreements that we have throughout both K-16 and PEB and everybody else, I mean, that's an issue.
I think the doctors just justified asking for an additional FTE instead of a 10% reduction.
That was coming later.
We'll see that in phase two. Representative Smith.
Keeping with my promise to not ask a question, I have a request.
Yes, sir.
Might the two of you afterwards come visit with me? This is so important, and I think the work you do is so important that I truly want to understand this, and I'm struggling with the prioritized list and HB 3182 and making sure those priorities line up. If you'd come visit me.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, be happy to.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Dr. Goldberg? Thank you, sir. You've gotten us 10 minutes ahead of schedule with your very succinct presentation, and we would now invite up Ms. Thorne. And, whoops.
No, that's, I just want to let the members know that we, because you took your binders with us, they presented new presentation documents to us, so you would just replace what you have in your binder with that. I believe those of you that left your binders here have the new ones. Yeah.
Do we just discard the old one?
Yes, please.
Ms. Thorne, for the record.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, I'm Jean Thorne, Administrator of the Public Employees Benefit Board. As you turn to, hopefully, you're in page five, just to give you a sense of what the board does, design, purchase, and administer health and other benefits for state employees and their dependents. We're going to serve as a central purchaser of health care and other benefits for state employees and their dependents. On page six, in terms of customers, about 45,000 state employees and their 67,500 dependents. We work with 116 state agencies and seven university campuses. We also have about 3,700 retired state employees who are pre-Medicare eligible. They can purchase insurance after they retire. They're not yet eligible through PEB. Once they are Medicare eligible, they would then purchase coverage through PERS. We also work with 21 semi-independent agencies, various POPs, commission, potato commissions, et cetera. There are four self-pay groups, so for instance, foster parents could actually purchase health care coverage for themselves.
May I stop you and inquire, how do these people come forward? Do they petition to be accepted by PEB or...
Madam Chair, in
I'm violating my own rule. The Public Employees Benefit Board.
In most of the cases, I believe it has actually required a statutory change to bring some of these other groups in. And so the board actually did express concerns in a policy position a few years ago about being careful that high-risk groups aren't coming in a way that then means the state has to pay more out because you're bringing in and bringing in additional costs. But some of these groups have come in through legislation, some of the self-pay groups.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Senator Morris.
What's the total number then covered?
We have, Madam Chair, Senator Morris, we have about 115,000 members who are actually covered right now under PEB. To give you some historical perspective, PEB was actually formed in 1998. There were two boards before that, the State Employees Benefit Board, which management represented, and I believe also some represented, and then the Bargaining Units Benefit Board, which was, again, for the bargaining. So they came together into a single board in 1998. The first few years were really spent trying to bring together the various plans, consolidate plans, bring together the operations. In late 2002, the board then established its strategic vision for future planning and contracting. I'll be talking about this in a moment because we really are moving into a whole new era now as we speak, because the board has a request for proposals out right now, which is very different than what has been in place before, with plans to implement key elements of this strategic vision beginning January of 2006. So I'll get to that in just a moment. So I think, you know, we went through the formative years of PEB being formed and are now really looking at making some of the changes and requesting or demanding some changes in the healthcare delivery system that we think makes sense in the long term. In terms of the mission and goals, to provide a high-quality plan of health and other benefits for state employees that are cost-affordable to both the employees and the state, Statutory authority is set out here in terms of the duties and powers of the benefit board. The goals are actually laid out in statute, provide employee choice among high-quality plans. The board works to receive sick employee input and feedback, promote a competitive healthcare marketplace, ensure plan performance through measurable benchmarks. And I would say at this point, and as we get to benchmarks, I'll want to talk a little bit about performance measurements. Those really have been more on the administrative side. And as we talk about the vision, you'll see that we really are looking for more in terms of quality measures from the healthcare delivery system. Providing employer flexibility in plan design and contracting. We are the largest employer-based purchaser of healthcare in the state, and in that regard feel that there are certain things that we may be able to request that the healthcare delivery system should be able to follow through on.
Senator Morrison.
Thank you. Going back to provide employee choice among high-quality plans, isn't this kind of in opposition with what we're the direction you're trying to go?
Madam Chair and Senator Morissette, I think that actually it is interesting seeing this goal in statute, because one of the things the board did do back in 2002 was to consolidate. I think there were 17 different plans at the time, and really move to have fewer plans available. I think what you'll see is that as we move towards the implementation of the vision, which I'll talk about in a moment, I think you'll see more choice, really probably more from community-based plans than there has been before. Continuing on with our goals, providing quality customer service and communications, applying creativity and innovation to improve delivery of services, designing benefit plans that enhance recruitment and retention. I think one of the things we've heard quite often, especially from human resources people in various agencies, is the importance of a benefit package to really recruit and retain employees. And lastly, seek to improve the health of members. And I think as we get into the vision for 2007, this is really becoming more of an emphasis. The organization charts, really 03, 05, and 05, 07 are pretty much the same. Very small number of staff really involved in providing customer service to the members and agencies, and I'll get to this in a moment. But as you can see, administrator support, a director of operations who actually supervises some of the ongoing work, and one FTE really involved in program development. So again, 05, 07, almost exactly the same. In terms of programs and services, this is a board. It's a policy board. I serve at the pleasure of the board. There are four management representatives. Two of those, by statute, include the DAS director or designee. Currently, the designee, who also serves as the board chair, is the administrator of risk management, whoops, new name, State Services Division, who you'll be hearing from. Also, the administrator of the Office of Health Policy and Research, Dr. Goldberg, by position, serves as one of the management representatives. There are four non-management representatives, specifically by statute. Two represent the largest union, SEIU. One is to represent the next largest union, which is AFSCME, and then one to represent all others. And currently that seat is occupied by a professor at Western Oregon University. There are two members of the Legislative Assembly who are non-voting. One is Representative Krupp, and the other is Senator Beyer, who are members of the board.
That's not correct. Excuse me.
You're doing so well.
Oh, no. Wait a moment, Senator. Just hang on here.
Take it outside, boys. Please continue.
Continue on. The board has formed itself into three working committees. I will tell you, this board is very involved. I've never worked for a board before, and this is a board that's very involved. Plan Design Committee really looks more towards the future in terms of what kind of benefits, what kind of copay structure, et cetera. Operations, I would say, deals more with the present, so if there are member appeals on various issues. And then the Wellness Subcommittee really focuses on engaging members in meetings and staying healthy. We'll talk about some of those activities in a moment. The board designs, negotiates, purchases, and administers the medical, dental, and life insurance plans. Long-term care, disability, and accidental death and dismemberment insurance plans, those are optional.
May I go back to page 21 for a second? When you're talking about operations, that part of your shop does appeals?
Yes.
And how does that work?
Madam Chair, usually what it may be an issue of is a member has missed the deadline for making a change in the plans, or and there is certain latitude that the staff themselves can provide. But then there are circumstances where it will go to the operations subcommittee, which is actually board members, where they will look at issues such as how many times was the member notified? Have they, you know, was the information included on their pay stub?
So this doesn't rise to the level of like administrative law judges? Or?
No.
Okay.
This is more around whether they're eligible for coverage and whether they should have an opportunity to change plans or it's those kinds of issues.
Thank you.
So the board, besides medical, dental, life insurance, again, long-term care, et cetera, dependent care and health care flexible spending account. The health care flexible spending account is new. We've just begun that January 1st. And then also consolidated omnibus budget reconciliation act, COBRA 1985, which is coverage for post-employment for a certain number of months that people can purchase and retiree plans. Again, these are self-pay where people would choose to pay for those.
Senator Morse.
Raise the question, Gene. The 3,700 retirees that are in the plan, mm-hmm. are they self-pay? Or
yes,
they are.
They're self-pay. Senator Morse, yes.
Okay.
Yes, they would pay that themselves. There's no additional state benefit towards it.
Are they actuarially rated?
No, they are part of the pool. So, in fact, they're able to get a rate that would be lower than if they were a separate pool of retirees by themselves.
This is not the time and place, but the actuarial costs of those employees would be interesting to understand its influence on the pool.
Thank you. Ms. Parker, I think, is sketching that for us. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Gene, can you send me information on the job description for the administrator and the director of operations? It seems like the span of control was about 1 to 8 with the two, and it looks like you're dealing with a very, very professional staff.
Yes, I can certainly do that. I think one of the points is that much of my time is really spent working more directly with the board, supporting the board in the planning, long-range planning, and the director of operations, which is a new position we've just had this year, is really trying to deal with the day-to-day operations of customer service and contracting, et cetera. But we'll be happy to send you job descriptions.
I'll follow on that, if I may, Madam Chair. The director of operations was approved by the legislature last session because of the change in the complexity and the issues around health plans. So they,
please ignore my question. If this is an issue,
it was,
you dug this well recently. No reason to dig it again.
Yeah, this is as Ms. Thorne said, this is a fairly new position. It was authorized by the assembly in the 2003 session.
Ms. Parker, I think you can strike that one, too.
Crossing up.
Please continue.
Okay. On page 23, you'll see some of the wellness activities that has really been a focus of the board over the last few years. Disease management programs where our staff work with staff from the carriers to really identify people with asthma, diabetes, and heart conditions and work to help better manage their care. The actual management of the care occurs through the carriers, our current carriers or regions. And Kaiser. This last summer, we had a pilot walking well program where we really encouraged state employees from certain state agencies to engage in a walking program. They all got little pedometers. I won't tell you how few steps I've taken today. but we asked them at the, in exchange for that, we wanted some survey information pre and post. We work with public health on the design of that, and we're just analyzing that now, and also want them to do the online health risk assessment to really encourage people to understand their health risks. So we're analyzing that information. We had very good feedback that a number of employees said, and these were not people who were walking before especially, that they were people who really needed the exercise, and this encouraged them to do that. We began a pilot tobacco cessation program just this past month to support members who wish to quit smoking. We are piggybacking off the free and clear the tobacco quit line that the state has, but then pay for additional counseling and nicotine replacement therapy. We have online health risk assessments and educational tools that that members can access, and also do health screenings and health education classes on site, both at the PEB clinic across the street here, and then as we work around the state in various state agencies as well. In terms of how we deliver our services, the medical, dental, life, disability, long-term care insurance is all delivered through insurance carriers. As I noted, our current carriers are Regents and Kaiser for medical. For dental, we have ODS, Kaiser, and Willamette. Standard insurance covers disability, and Unum has long-term care insurance. There's administration of coverage for retirees and members that are not in our payroll system. We contract with a third-party administrator to handle that, as well as administration of flexible spending accounts. And then the wellness activities are delivered through contracts with wellness vendors. So, for instance, the wellness clinic across the street is a contract operation. We also contract with WebMD for some of the online services. As far as the staff functions themselves, again, we have 17 positions supporting the board activities, including planning for implementation of new programs or approaches. That's much of what I do, and also our program development coordinator. Given all the various subcommittees, the subcommittees all meet at least once a month. The board meets once a month, so there's also the staff support just taking minutes.
Senator Morrison.
I'm on your board. You didn't know that. I've been appointed.
Have you been? Oh.
Yes.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Morrison.
You will send me a notification of meeting times, and I will be there.
We will certainly let you know that. We hadn't been notified yet.
And his pedometer, please.
My pedometer. I walk from the Lee Apartments every day. Okay. I want to measure.
And Madam Chair, Senator Morrison, you have to agree to do a survey.
I will do it.
Okay, we will give you a pedometer then. So welcome. I hope you will enjoy your time.
Oh, I look forward to it. Wonderful.
Over half of our staff provide customer service to members and state agencies and vendors. And so whether it's dealing with the payroll and benefit representatives of agencies or members directly, insurance law, I will tell you, probably most of you know my background with the Oregon Health Plan, and I've not dealt with insurance law before. And after staff have given me tutorials, my eyes glaze over about all the various, you have to do this within 60 days, and you can't do this in a certain number of times. So there is a lot of eligibility issues that are really tied up with IRS regulations as well. So we have about 9 or 10 of the staff really involved in providing a customer service. One FTE, which is coordinating and communicating information related to benefits and board activities. We have monthly newsletter. We have web information. We have a quarterly health-related newsletter. We have open enrollment, new employee enrollment information that is all produced out of our office. We have one position to administer the vendor contracts, and then 1.83 to really manage the operational budget and stabilization.
Senator Chair.
Representative Vakia.
Just going back to your wellness activities on page 23, really because I thought you might cover it in the staff function, but who provides those activities?
Madam Chair and Representative Bakken, we actually contract the Oregon Wellness Center to do the, for instance, the health screens, health education classes, and they help coordinate the pilot Walking Well program. We contract with Free and Clear to operate the tobacco cessation program. The online health risk assessment and educational tools, we contract with WebMD. And then disease management is really a collaborative approach to our staff working with Kaiser and Regent staff.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. If I was in Bandon, or if I was in Joseph, or if I was in Lakeview, how would I take advantage of those programs?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, we really have, our clinic has worked and under the direction of Wellness Committee to really move services out of Salem as much as possible. And so, for instance, I'm not sure if they got to Joseph, but I do know that the clinic staff were out in John Day and Burns and some of those areas where they'll go around, do set up for a day to do on-site health screening. Much of what they have found, actually, as they get to eat, especially to rural parts of Oregon, they will identify people with health risks who had no idea they had health risks, sure, who may have not seen a doctor for years, and work to hook them up with a local primary care provider.
How do you get the word out to the folks that you're going to be in those communities?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, we usually have, for some of the larger agencies, like the 20 largest agencies, have agency wellness coordinators. And they are our main point of contact, who will then put us in touch with local people. The other thing that will occur is that, for instance, if the clinic staff are going to go to Ontario, maybe they'll begin with working with the staff at Snake River, but then also they'll get contacts with the other agencies in the area to set up it may be a separate screening, but they work with the local management staff or the agency wellness coordinators. Then those people, in turn, the local people, will inform the employees in the area of what is available and when that's available.
Just a quick follow-up. But I would just request as you continue with this good work that remember that Ontario and Pendleton, from our perspective, isn't rural anymore. And when you get into, we still have a lot of folks who need assistance in the smallest of small communities.
As we look at the, I've already been through that. Okay, we went back two pages. On page 26, I would really like just take a few moments to talk about the board's vision for 2017. Because I noted the board really is moving towards a whole new vision of what its expectations are for the healthcare delivery system and its contract relationships with it. This really grew out of frustration, I believe. The board felt that we are not able to really look at the quality of healthcare, what's the value of what we're getting for the dollars that are being spent. And so the board put together this vision, adopted in December of 2002, but we are moving ahead with this now for changes beginning January of 2006. So there are a number of components really saying we want to have an innovative delivery system that provides or focuses on evidence-based medicine, again, the use of evidence to support the practice. A focus on improving quality and outcomes, not just providing health care. As you all know, money, you can go see a doctor, the visit gets paid whether it does any good or not. We really are saying we want to look at what are the outcomes of the services that are provided. What are we getting for the dollars? Promotion of consumer and education and informed choices. This is really about consumers understanding their own health risks, understanding what their treatment options might be, what the outcomes might be of those different options, and working together with their healthcare professional and making some of those choices. Appropriate market and consumer incentives that encourage the right care at the right time. Is back surgery the first thing you go to if you've got a back problem? Maybe not. Maybe there are other less invasive treatments, and then if we can establish copay structures that may encourage some of those first, whether it's on the consumer side or on the provider side. System-wide transparency. It's very difficult to get information on costs, on outcomes, on volume of what is occurring in hospitals or in provider offices, or the satisfaction that patients may have with various healthcare providers. So getting more information in the hands of consumers. And then benefits affordable to the state and employees. This is really a long-term strategy. HEB is a leader in Oregon on this, and there are many other places in the United States where there have been coalitions of very large private purchasers, employers, coming together to really push for these kinds of changes in the healthcare delivery system. But the goal saying we're looking for improved health status for our workforce, we want to assure value for the state's healthcare dollars, and we want to try to stabilize the cost trend. As you know, costs have been going up and up and up in the private sector and in public sector. So the board really said they'd had this vision, spent about a year getting feedback from stakeholders, and then I came to the board last March. We began talking about how do we take this vision now and translate it into something that's real. So over the last several months, we worked with a consultant from the Foundation for Accountability who had a number of other technical groups. We had a lot of provider feedback where we took that vision and we translated those into criteria for purchasing services and evaluating outcomes, with the intent then that some of those strategies will be expected statewide, really recognizing, you know, that different models are necessary for different areas of the state. What you can do in Portland is not what you can do in Burns, but we should have expectations in terms of the outcomes, for instance, for diabetic patients, which should be similar whether you're in Portland or Burns. And so one of the areas that the board received clarification on from the 2003 session was that we do have the authority to self-insure. So that does provide flexibility that we believe we likely will end up with, we don't have sufficient reserves to completely self-insure, but we can do more direct contracting with groups who may not have been able to work with us before. The timeline, we issued a request for information in September to get some sense of whether there was interest on the part of the healthcare marketplace to play with us. We got an overwhelming response. We had responses from 35 different vendors who were interested in knowing the kinds of criteria we were going to be looking at. We issued January 10th, we issued a request for proposal for pilots and statewide services. We had not gone out with an RFP since 2001, so everything is being put out to bid for 2006. The proposals will come in late February. We do believe, just on initial notice of intent, that we will have good response from the marketplace, whether it's from insurance carriers or other health plans that may want to contract with us on a self-funded basis. We'll be going through the process then, March through June, of evaluating proposals, negotiating with the finalists. The board is then scheduled to make decisions in June on the 2006 contractors. So we would then be going through the process and developing materials and employing those choices.
Madam Chair.
Representative Ivanka.
You mentioned that your reserves are inadequate in order to self-insure. Is that a topic that the board has discussed before, is building reserves to the point where that would be an option for the state?
Madam Chair and Representative Avakian, we actually, the reserves are sufficient at this point to allow, and we're continuing to refine and work with the Department of Justice around the requirements here, but could allow us to carve out and separately self-insure prescription drugs and potentially do some regional programs. And I think to the first-year estimate to fully fund any reserve requirements was about $67 million. We currently have about $32 million in the stabilization fund. So I think this is, we'll be looking at, as the proposals come in, we expect we'll get a combination of fully insured proposals and ones that might be self-funded that the board will need to be looking at where they think they can best apply those reserves. And so that is an issue. Our reserves grow by about $6 million per year, primarily from people who opt out because they have other group coverage. They receive some money, and the rest of the money goes into our stabilization fund.
Okay, you weren't then implying an across the board self-insurance program for all the insurance needs of the state, but just particular projects in certain areas.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Vlocky, I think that's, given our reserve requirements, and also wanting to see what comes in, we have the flexibility to be able to potentially fund a number of different models that maybe we could not before.
Thank you. This is an issue that I had worked on prior to Gene's arrival at PEP. We'd actually put together a self-insurance task force, of which I participated in quite a few meetings during the interim of 01, or the 02 interim time period, I think it was. And one of the things we realized was that the board, the reserves that would be necessary for an entire self-insured program would be rather large, given the models that of current usage of services by the 120-some-odd thousand people that are covered by PEP. The way to change that, I think, is the opportunity now that is before us, and it's something that I'm going to ask Gene to talk about at some point. In fact, you're coming to my office tomorrow, I believe. are HSAs, the health savings accounts, which are newly in place, relatively speaking. The rules were written last year and now have begun to be accepted in the marketplace. I've sit on the Sublimity Fire Board, and we've just moved our two paid personnel to HSAs. We're saving a considerable amount of money on the premium. It empowers the two employees substantially because now they're no longer a part of an HMO. They can go to any physician of their choice to receive services. It's fee for service. And we, the Fire Board, put their deductible amount into their HSA every year. So there's no out-of-pocket expense to them beyond what they were spending previously in terms of their share of the premium every year. This, I think, is a marvelous opportunity, and I want to see us, as the board, explore this greater in the future. I think it's an opportunity for us to save money and build reserves so that if the state at some point decided to self-insure, and this would be some time down the road, it would be a more realistic proposal in my mind because we would have, A, number one, the reserves, and number two, you would have a lower utilization because with HSAs, because patients take more responsibility for their own health care, utilization goes down considerably when HSAs are in place in organizations. So if we utilize the system less because patients are taking more responsibility and we have greater reserves, then the equation of self-insurance becomes much more palatable. Because the reason we chose not to go forward with self-insurance because the equation, frankly, is risky. That we would actually have more, we could actually lose money as a state in terms of the amount of premium that we would be not paying, but the amount of payout that would be going out on a yearly basis. So if the utilization changes, then it seems to me that that is something in the future. And we passed that bill last session to allow this as an option down the road. And I think it's one of those things that we will have to continue to look at in the future is how the changing face of the incentives for healthcare can be utilized possibly in the public employees' benefit board.
Thank you. If you turn to page 33, which moves to performance measures, I will tell you I'm not too pleased with what we have in terms of performance measures. At this point, they really are administrative. The one that you'll see as a chart was the average employee satisfaction with the PEB benefit program and the PEB annual survey, and that's the open enrollment survey. When we don't have mandatory open enrollment, as we haven't the last two or three years, we had 600 and some responses out of 45,000 employees. So although it shows fairly good satisfaction, I don't know how valid this is as a measure. I do think that it's likely we will have mandatory open enrollment this next year because I'm anticipating a number of changes. We also will have a new online benefit management system, so I think we can get that response rate up. So I think that is something with a better response rate, it becomes a more valid measure. We also have some performance measurements around the administrative assessment. We have, by statute, the assessment that pays for PEP operations could go to 2%. We've been at 0.6% for a number of years. We have performance standards for our insurance carriers. They are primarily related to issues like claims processing, lag time in claims, how long customers have to wait on the phone. I think that as we move towards this whole new vision of what we are looking for from the healthcare delivery system, we are going to be asking for tracking around issues such as immunizations, around care for diabetics, what is happening in terms of blood sugar levels. We'll be looking at a number of the areas that I think actually Dr. Goldberg talked about in terms of being some of these state benchmarks that we will be saying we want to look at some of these outcomes for PEB members. So I think as we move down that road that we would want to be looking at having benchmarks that really are performance measures that really relate more directly to the quality of the care that our members receive. And you'll see on page 35, this is a survey. It says currently in progress. I got the results last night at 5 o'clock. which was a DAS survey, and this portion went out to payroll and benefit representatives in terms of their work with HIB, and I think we got good marks in terms of being responsive, of having correct information. As we move to the prioritized list, page 39, basically we have three categories. First is operations, basically the staff, those that keep, I'd say, keep the train running. The second, the stabilization fund, that will provide the ability for us to look at self-funding programs in the future. The last is flexible benefit administration. Because this is optional, dependent care and health care are flexible spending accounts. We would rate that as being a lower priority than some of the mandated services. In reduction options, we have, beginning on page 43, as I look at our budget, it was interesting dealing with this budget because it is a very, I would say, a lean budget, we did not find a lot of places that we could take reductions without really having a significant impact. The first would be to cut back on our printing budget, but our newsletter is our main way of communicating. We have a number of employees who receive that electronically. We could look at potentially expanding that, but that would cut our printing budget about in half. Reduction in consulting services, that really helps the board deal with some of the strategic planning. The $60,000 reduction is out of a professional services category of about $98,000. The next, it says reduce one customer service staff position. It's actually 1.7 FTE. This would mean people would have to wait longer before they got responses. And so there's a backlog in responding to customers. They, in turn, may then go to their own agency staff who may not be able to answer, or it may even be the agency staff calling who then there's just a backlog in being able to be responsive.
Senator Morissette.
You're going to create more work for us.
Madam Chair and Senator Morrison.
If they can't get any more complaints, we will call and holler at you for not getting the word out.
I've been there before.
I hear a conflict arising on that side of the table.
I think again, we have so such a limited number of staff, it's really hard to say you can take reductions without having an impact. The next would be taking point two of our one communications coordinator out. This assumes that this person would stay at a point eight. But again, communicating to members, especially during this time when we see and see major changes, is really important. We received a position in the last session to handle all our contracting. This would be to eliminate this position. It would mean it would have to be absorbed in other parts of DAS. The medical contracting is very different than kind of general personal services contracting, and so there would be a concern about the ability to absorb that. And then the last reduction really is taking half of two positions, half of the program development coordinator and half of the director of operations, again, assuming that they would stay, which would mean likely the administrator absorbs that work, which in turn means there's less ability to assist the board in doing some of the longer range planning that we've been engaged in quite heavily, especially over this last year.
Ms. Thorne, I think it's interesting that just serendipitously you have two board members sitting on this panel. Did you review these House Bill 3182 cuts with your board in the preparation of your budget document?
Madam Chair, no, we did not.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Thorne?
Yes.
Representative Krupp.
Thank you, Madam. Gene, when you come to the office tomorrow, could you be prepared to answer some questions for me about contracting and your RFP process, those kinds of things? Thank you.
Anything else from Ms. Thornton? Thank you very much for your presentation, and we would now invite up the Human Resources Service Division Manager, Sue Wilson. Good morning, Ms. Wilson, and if you'd state your name for the record.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Susan Wilson. I'm Administrator of the Human Resource Services Division in Department of Administrative Services. And I think we have some slides that we have prepared. I wanted to go over our program area for you. I know I've had a chance to talk with most of you at a previous Ways and Means presentation on sort of the personnel system overall in the state. What we're focused on today is our division within the Department of Administrative Services. We, as the Human Resource Services Division, provide statewide direction and leadership to agencies in the area of human resource management. This enables the state to act as one employer. There are a number of advantages in trying to deal with the state as one employer, and statutorily we are required to in many ways to provide for a common human resource background for all folks. Because of that, we centrally manage state personnel systems, which include the setting of all classifications and compensation systems, our labor relations, our collective bargaining, and the collection and maintenance of all employee data. That data we'll talk a little bit about later then is used to generate a number of things like the state payroll. So we are the collection point for that.
I don't want to take the time in this stage of the Ways and Means process, but I would like to ask Dallas to flag for further committee consideration the whole issue of classification and employee data and how job descriptions are written, moving people from step to step, and come back to that in phase two.
Thank you. Moving on, in essence, the mission and goals then for our group are to support the success and accountability of state government. We feel that the having a stable workforce and skilled workforce is absolutely critical for the state to be able to provide the services that it does and to reach its mission. We are statutorily charged with several areas of responsibility in chapters ORS Chapter 240 and ORS Chapter 243 are key statutes that set out the responsibilities that we are charged to do. In the statutes, we are referred to as the Personnel Division, but we have been, in recent years, renamed Human Resources. Some of the goals that we have as a division are to negotiate and manage all the collective bargaining contracts that there are in state government. We do have 32 collective bargaining contracts. Covers about 27,000 state employees. We not only negotiate those, but during the interim period, we manage those contracts in terms of third-level grievances and working on a number of letters of agreement and other issues that arise in between the bargaining sessions. We also develop and maintain statewide personnel rules so that we have collective bargaining contracts related to those folks who are covered by those. We have personnel rules that apply sometimes statewide and sometimes to those people who aren't covered by bargaining contracts. We train state employees. Particularly, we work on management training and trying to leverage our training resources within state agencies as much as we can. Recruiting a qualified workforce is also a critical element of the work that we try to do. And then, obviously, employment liability is one of the highest liabilities right now that's out there. We try to ensure that we do comply with personnel law and policies within the agencies. On our organization chart.
Could you speak to the question of how you coordinate with other agencies that have HR departments, human resource departments, and how you make sure that there is a consistent administration of human resource functions? You do it, but let's take ODOT, for example, and I'm not picking on ODOT. They have a big human resources. What's the connect point between you guys giving guidance to state agencies and state agencies delivering at their own agency level?
Madam Chair, good question. I think where we've had the relationship varies and has varied over the years. I'd say where we are right now is we have a pretty close working relationship with all of the agency human resource managers. I meet with them regularly. We talk about common problems and try to work through those. Our personnel rules do apply to all state agencies, and we therefore work with those agencies closely in the application of the personnel rules. Our labor relations staff work closely with the HR people, say in ODOT, for a number of contracts that they have with their employees. We also, and you'll see here on our org chart, we also have an audit function, which means that we periodically will take an area where we want to check for compliance and check to make sure things are being applied in the same way across state government, and our auditors will go in. We do areas like anytime an allocation to a new class takes place, we go in and we audit those to make sure that people are applying those appropriately across state government. Use of work out of class, use of other personnel rules, we go in and audit.
Sure. Thank you. And along the lines of ODOT, do you do civil rights work? Is that part of what your staff monitors in terms of compliance with law?
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, no, we do not have a civil rights section within our human resource division. ODOT has some specific federal requirements related to civil rights and their monitoring, and they do have some specific staff working on civil rights. We do try to work closely with the Governor's Office of Affirmative Action on any sort of information, and we are involved, I would say, to the extent that we provide a lot of data out of our systems that is used then in some of those areas.
Thank you.
Senator Smith. Thank you, Chair Johnson. Can you have someone send me information, an executive summary on the state's affirmative action policy?
Certainly.
No, please not a big, thick book, just 2 pages.
Absolutely. We'll work, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, we'll work with the Affirmative Action Office to get you a summary.
And again, I'm going to exercise the prerogative of the chair. Any responses that you make to members, would you please pass them through Dallas so we can get it to all committee members?
Happy to do that.
Thank you.
One other. I do make sure that we understand how you deal with violence in the workplace in state agencies. Could you get us all information about your process and procedures?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, we do have policies related to that, and we'll be happy to provide you with those policies.
Thank you.
On our org chart on page 13 shows you the structure of how we are laid out in the Human Resource Services Division. We have 55.5 FTE currently. We are organized into 4 main divisions or sections of the division. Our labor relations has classification and compensation. Our statewide training and development services, which also includes recruitment, has one section. Our management and consultation is a section, and HR audits, the audit program, and the personnel systems are an additional section. Each of those has one manager, so we have, including myself, 5 managers in the division. We currently have a pretty low vacancy rate, and I have just filled the training, development, and recruitment management position, which has been vacant for about 5 months. Other than that, we have very few vacancies available. Although we do have a coordinator position in our classification compensation that we're having a heck of a time filling. And I've now had 2 failed recruitments on that, and I'm just having – it's very difficult to find somebody with class and comp expertise who would like to come to work for the state. So we're trying. Our org chart on page 14 then shows the differences in our 0507 as proposed budget. And the transferring out of one position, transferring in another position, which I know that was talked about yesterday with one of the presentations, the trainer position. And then I'll talk about some of the other program areas where these are affected as we go through. On page 17, administration is in essence myself, an administrative assistant and a business operations person to try to provide the continuity, coordination, and communication related to managing the division and working with all state agencies on their human resource issues. Our labor relations, classification, and compensation section, again, I think pretty clearly we pointed out their job is mostly focused on union relations and negotiation of contracts and managing those contracts. And then also talking about the state's classification compensation system, which I think we talked about a little bit as a larger group previously.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What percent of the state's employee population is represented by unions?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, a very large percentage, about 32,000 employees, about 27,000 of those are represented.
Thank you.
On page 19 is a
slide related to our human resource management consultation section. These are the folks who take any of the changes that happen in federal law and state law and translate those into state policies that we then apply state across state government related to employees. They also are playing more and more of a role in advising state agencies and providing assistance in the interpretation of state laws, federal laws, working with the Department of Justice, but we provide a number of trainings that we put together on the practical applications of running HR operations within state government. As things become more complex related to employee relations, we find these people are being called on more and more to provide assistance. We also, within this section, actually serve as the personnel office for 12 small agencies. And we anticipate, I know of at least three additional agencies who are in their budgets this time, assuming that we're going to be taking over their human resource function. It's very difficult in a small agency to have someone who can cover the breadth of operation that's needed to do HR, and it becomes more feasible for them to do for a fee for us. We also, within this section, also have the Employee Suggestions Award Program, and we can provide you some additional information and statistics on that.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. When you provide those services to other smaller state agencies, how do you bill them? How do you compensate your...
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, for the most part, our fees and assessments are based on the number of personnel. So it's based on FTE. So if we are helping an agency that has 20 staff, they will be paying a higher fee than an agency that has 3 staff.
Could you provide the committee with
absolutely
that information?
We'll do that formula.
Thank you. Go ahead.
On page 20, Human Resource System Services and Audits, again, these are the people who work with what is called the Position and Personnel Database, PPDB. This is a central storage for all information related to state employees and history. This information is used both for budgeting, payroll, and for general reporting. As much as possible, it is not the most user-friendly system to be able to get information out of, but we're working to get as much data as we can to provide some trend information for the legislature also.
How long do you keep that data?
We have the data currently back to 1977 with the system itself. That's pretty much when we started. They started gathering and downloading information. It happened to be the same year I started, and I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but they have all. I'm there completely.
So this is individual employees back to 1977.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
I'm curious, is there any kind of guidance to state agencies about how long this data gets retained?
Madam Chair, there is some difference in relationship to what is maintained in personnel files versus what we have in a centralized database. We have very basic information. We have names and salary rates and those types of things, but there are Secretary of State guidelines for the actual maintenance and timelines for maintenance of personnel records within the state. This section also coordinates and reconciles information to administer the retirement plans and determining eligibility of employees for the retirement plan. One thing that is new is that in the last session, the legislature, in revamping and creating a new retirement system, created some new procedures that we as a state, as one employer, must follow in working with PERS and the new J Clarity system. This has required in the past that information and data related to retirement was reconciled once a year. It's now required that this be reconciled every month. And there are some additional reporting and some excessive workload issues. What we've done is to work with the agencies, and in previously, PERS often worked with each agency individually, meaning PERS had interaction with 185 different agencies at least on data related to individuals. We worked with the agencies and said, this is really a centralized function. We can do this without you having to try and train your staff. We will bring in 2 FTE and we will provide this as a statewide service.
So this is now we are doing the monthly reconciliation of the PERS data. We are working with PERS directly, so they have one point of contact for the state and not 180. We're finding that the data is, there are fewer errors, and that this is something that the agencies have been very supportive of, and PERS also. And this is also the section, then, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that conduct agency audits to ensure compliance with personnel statutes, rules, and policies. They do have an audit schedule, but then they also respond to particular questions or if an issue should arise that we want to get more information on, they will do a special audit on those areas. The statewide training, development, and recruitment section provides training and development services, including management training, to all state agencies. Now, many agencies do have, if especially the large ones, may have someone doing training or staff doing particular training for the agency itself on a particular skill set. For example, ODOT will have safety trainers for people working on road crews. Where we focus our effort is on those types of trainings that can cross all agency lines. We have a full new cadre of management training, which we're trying to focus on people as state managers to be able to have transferable skills. Also to focus on people's particular needs, such as a number of people who've been in technical positions for many years find themselves in management somewhere down the line. They may have no training in the management area. We do have a specific training which we try to help guide those people into the new skill set needed for management as a different skill set than those who have done a technical position.
Do you have a standardized curriculum or set of curricula? And let me tell you why I ask. I worked for a state agency in early and mid-90s, and that was when much employee training was very much in vogue. And we did things like take managers and crumple up tinfoil balls and put them in a bag to prove that we all could work well together. It was stunning to me how much money was wasted putting tinfoil balls in bags.
Can you learn how to bark like a dog?
I learned to bark like a dog. We did some very special training. And I am looking for some reassurance to this committee, and I would dare say the public, that we have an appropriate curriculum and that there are some filters on how much training and what quality and quantity of training state agency employees can access. I think the idea of cross-training is great, but barking dogs and balled-up tinfoil left a sort of permanent scar on my little psyche. And
I'm looking chairing a subcommittee on ways and means.
You've been all bad.
You were all bad.
You know, I will attribute this success to balled-up tinfoil, but could you give us a little reassurance about curricula?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't think we have any tinfoil. I do think I took that training, too. That's the one with tennis balls. But where we are focused right now is really, obviously, on more specific skills, on-the-job skills that we can get our hands around. We talk to and we train managers on areas like doing performance evaluations, how to manage the performance of your staff, setting out expectations with your staff, learning about performance measures, learning about some of those types of things that are much more directly related. I'd be happy to provide a list of sort of the areas within each of the areas that we have that we do. Again, we also have some training for example, for people who may have management experience but are new to state government. What are the things that they need to know to be able to be successful?
I'm going to ask on behalf of the full committee that you provide that again through our committee staff and we disseminate it to everyone. I'm looking at the full array of offerings and how often employees are able to access those training opportunities, both at the management level and at the staff level. Representative Swift.
May I want to dovetail off of that. What about folks in the most remote parts of the state? Are they able to access those classes via email or not email, but
online? Madam Chair, Representative Smith, we have a variety of things, and I need to explain that obviously there are trainings going on that we are not involved with. Agencies themselves do still sometimes have trainings that they do, and we are not involved with those. I'll talk a little bit about that more.
What we have done is we have brought together, just like I've brought together the human resource managers, we've brought together all the state training managers. They are now working cooperatively with one another to the point that they even developed a strategic learning plan for the state, that they are all trying to put their resources towards that. We have done a couple of regional things. Online training is something that is being used to a certain extent with mixed reviews. What we have done a couple of times recently is we've called them training roundups. And we sent trainers from three different agencies, one to Eastern Oregon as a group, one to Southern Oregon. They went for 3 days. They invited employees from any agencies in those areas to come and attend half-day sessions in which they could choose a variety of topic areas. The cost was much less than bringing people into Salem. We were able to use the expertise of all the various agencies and send people out. We've gotten very good reviews, a good success rate, and I think that's something we'll continue. The statewide training, development, and recruitment section also provides central recruiting assistance to state agencies. Again, a number of the larger agencies have delegated authority to do their own recruitments. They do have to enter their recruiting list into our system, and we do have a website with all state jobs available. But we also do certain central things that we think make sense, such as we have a statewide contract for advertising for recruitment. So if you look in the papers and you see that ad called the State of Opportunity, it may have recruitments from a variety of agencies. We manage that contract so that we can get a lower statewide rate instead of each agency going out on their own. In terms of our performance measures, one of the things that we felt important to measure is, again, with the goal of trying to have a stable workforce, looking at what our turnover is in state government. And we try for a 5.5%, which is a fairly standard industry benchmark for a turnover rate. We generally figure if we're up to 10% in a particular classification, then we have a problem. Our turnover rate has been actually going down in the last couple of years. It is now starting, and we've just gotten the 2004 data, which I don't believe is on your chart. We are up to 4.9%, so we have gone up a little bit.
That's actually my question, Sue. The chart that you provided, because it doesn't have the 2004 data, indicates that reduction. But that's 2003, is that last year, and as you know, we put into play some, passed into law some changes to PERS, and that is bound to have some type of a negative effect. Do you think that's what you're seeing now in terms of instability in the workforce?
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, two issues there. These performance measures, its standard definition of turnover does not include retirement. So this data does not include retirement. There are other reasons. Did we see a spike in retirement? Absolutely. In 2003, our retirement numbers were probably double our normal. They're back down so far this year, but as we talked about before, I think people are waiting to see what happens with court cases before making decisions sometimes related to retirement. But we definitely saw a spike in 2003, and that has had an impact. As far as this number, what we often see, again, there's some instability as we look at where we are in relation to market. When the economy is not good, people tend to be willing to stay at what they might consider a more stable position at a lower salary rate rather than moving out to something that may be less at a higher salary rate. As the economy improves, we will generally see our turnover rate go up, especially as we lose ground with market comparisons on salaries.
Madam Chair, follow-up. If to go outside of this chart, do you believe your analysis so far, do you think there is going to be an effect of PERS changes in terms of the overall retention of people? So in other words, are employees thinking that, maybe the PERS system has changed, I'm working at a lower rate in my job, maybe I ought to go look for a job in the private sector? Is that what you're hearing
Madam
or not?
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, we are anecdotally hearing that information. We are hearing that from some people who leave who say, I can go somewhere else at a higher rate and do my own retirement investment. We also hear at job fairs and in talking with people coming in to the state, your system is not as good as it used to be, and we're not sure about your retirement system at this point. Therefore, and that's probably more at the higher executive level where people are a little uncertain about making the commitment of coming to the state. Again, we don't have hard data at this point in time to really say, but that's some of what we've been hearing.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Our other performance measure on page 26 relates to our racial and ethnic diversity of the state workforce. We do have goals trying to have the state workforce reflect the ethnic diversity of the statewide civilian labor force. Where we are right now is we're not there. We've made some ground up, although in 2004, and we just got this data, we did drop again to 10.5%. And I don't have the statewide data yet to find out if the civilian workforce has gone down also.
Representative Smith. Thank you, Chair Johnson. This is on behalf of my good colleague, Senator Carter. This isn't acceptable. We've got to do a better job of making sure all Oregonians have access to employment with the state of Oregon. And, you know, I guess not right now, but in the coming weeks, I'd like to know specifically the steps we're going to take to make sure all Oregonians have an opportunity to jobs within the state, because that's just way, way too large of a gap.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Representative Vivekin.
I'm curious why this implies that the goal is the rate that the civilian workforce has as opposed to something else. I'm curious why that's the standard we're trying to reach. And then in addition to that, how does this compare to what the governor's office is doing within their affirmative action program?
Madam Chair, Representative Vaughan, the goal of trying to at least be representative of the state workforce is to try to at least show some parity with the civilian workforce. That was a goal that we felt was something that was at least a starting point for us to reach. We are working closely with the Governor's Affirmative Action Office. In fact, we've just in recent weeks been providing them with some data and are now starting to analyze that data more specifically by ethnic area, by racial area, to try and see where our issues lie. I do have someone on my staff whose role is involved with executive recruiting, but also very focused on trying to tap into some of those minority communities. And the state being seen as an employer of choice. What we're trying to deal with here is a history where, for whatever reason, and trying to get our hands around it, the state has not really been necessarily viewed by minority communities as an employer of choice or a place where you go. And we need to try to begin to turn that around so that we can open the door. And that means looking at our recruiting, that means looking at our application procedures, that means looking at the cultural environments within agencies themselves. And we will be giving some more reports related to what we're doing with the Affirmative Action Office on that.
Thank you. I want to follow up.
Representative Smith.
I guess I need assurance that folks in minority groups just don't, that they're not feeling like, what's the point of trying to apply?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, that's what we're trying to find out in terms of what do our pools look like? Are they applying? If they're not, why not?
So how many, how many minorities, I don't want to get political. Okay, thank you. I'd like to talk with you.
Not a problem.
Okay.
Our prioritized list on page 28, again, in looking at the overall programs and how we would prioritize, what I basically did in working with our managers and staff is say, what is it that we have to have centrally? What's the highest priority? So if it would go away, it would cause the greatest problem. So our highest priority became our human resource systems and the services. We have to have a centralized database for all employee information to be able to run a state payroll system and to be able to manage the overall operation. That becomes our number one priority. Our labor relations and classification compensation are also both very definitely statewide systems and approaches that we need to have centrally to be able to function. And those are things that would not work well to divvy out into agencies. The same with the human resource management and consultation. In providing central resource for small agencies, yes, we could, at somewhat of a cost to the agencies, spin that back off to them, and I think at a cost of some potential liability. Administration, again, simply for the communication aspect and the coordination, and then the statewide training, development, recruitment, only because, not that this is not a highly valuable, but it would be something with a cost that could be shifted out to agencies to perform those functions.
We have reached the end of the committee's time. If it is the will of the committee, we could go through these 10% reduction options, or we could start here first thing in the morning.
Let's finish it up.
I have to leave. I have an appointment.
Okay.
I have two kind of big, quick picture questions that I'd like to ask.
Okay, let's go with Senator Morris's questions, and then we'll finish up tomorrow.
Okay, thank you. As I recall in your presentation, Sue, in the joint committee, you mentioned that the average annual step increase is about 4.25%.
It's just 4.75%.
What percentage of the state employee group is at the top of the pay grade?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, I'm going to have to get you specific information on that. I believe that we are at about, I don't know if you have any of that. I think it's probably 40%, but I want to confirm that.
We're at the top of the
pyramid.
Okay. And then the second kind of big picture question is, and this is in the context of, you know, the gap between revenue and expenses in the state. Has the state undertaken any kind of a comprehensive reengineering process for organization in looking very thoughtfully at how we can reorganize functions and departments?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, agencies have looked at a number of areas within their own program delivery. We do have some issues, and there have been some undertakings in looking at how we do certain actions. Human Resources has been involved, for example, in the Scenic project, which is the building of the central data center, and looking at the human resource implications on that. In fact, we are in interim bargaining surrounding that. So we are involved in some of those systems as they open up and begin to come. But as a comprehensive, overall, completely cross-state government, no, we've not been
there. Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5501 and remind the committee that we start promptly at 8:30 tomorrow. We'll finish the State Services Division, Facilities Division, and Controllers Division. So without objection, we stand adjourned.